Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 260, recorded Monday, August 8th, 2016. Paul Adams. Triangulation is brought to you by Automatic, the connected car company that improves your driving and integrates your car into your digital life. For more information, visit automatic.com/twit and enter the code TWIT to get 20% off your purchase, plus free shipping. And by Corning. Corning's incredibly durable Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 optical cables are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. Go to corning.com/twit to save up to $130 on their superior Thunderbolt optical cables. And by Wealthfront. Wealthfront is a low-cost, automated investment service and the most sophisticated way to invest your money. Whether you've got millions or you're just starting out, visit wealthfront.com/triangulation and sign up to get your free personalized investment portfolio. That's wealthfront.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology. And I always like to learn a thing or two, and we call it Triangulation because it's me and them and you. You're the third leg of the stool, and your input is always welcome. If you're watching live at irc.twit.tv, and of course, after the fact, you can always email me at leo@twit.tv. Our guest today is Paul Adams. He is, and I should say, welcome, Paul, in Ireland right now. But he's coming in through the amazing telemographer.
Yeah.
Thanks.
I look like I'm from the future.
From the future, it's Paul Adams. For people watching the video, they might be a little puzzled because it looks so different because we're in a different studio because we're slowly dismantling the old studio and moving it over to the new studio. We'll be in there in 2 weeks. So. Do not be disturbed by the different look if you're watching on video. And those of you on audio, it actually sounds better. So that's a good thing. So Paul is a principal over there in Ireland at a company called Intercom. Communicating with customers shouldn't be this hard. And yet, so many companies seem to make it hard. And I'm thinking right now I need to call Comcast. Now you lived in the States, so I think you've heard the name once or twice.
Yeah, I know all too well.
And and I need to call them. Only they can fix the thing I'm having trouble with. But I don't want to. It is the last thing in the world I want to do, and I don't think that that's unusual. I think there are a lot of companies that have a hard time talking with customers, and a lot of customers who don't want to talk to companies. Companies often seem to make it hard on purpose. So what is Intercom, and how can it help me fix that problem?
Yeah, I hope that problem is a temporary glitch in humanity when we look back in a long time.
Well, it's expensive, right, to talk to customers. It's expensive.
Yeah, I think the internet changed it, honestly. One of the things that I say to people when I'm talking about where Intercom came from or why all these other poor technologies, in our opinion, I guess, came from, is the idea that before the internet, which of course was very recently, 20 years for practical purposes, all business was personal, face-to-face in most cases in stores or markets, and even the technology was things like the phone, which we now of course think is inherently personal, ironically. And over the last 20 years, the internet brought about scale, huge scale. So all these businesses, these small businesses, these stores could sell all their goods to anyone in the world. And I think with that scale brought about great growth and many problems. Like if you sell to 1 million people, you may have 10,000 people who are unhappy. And
it's a small percentage, relatively, but that's a lot of people, right, if you have to talk to them.
Yeah, and it's hard. This is like, you know, how do you deal with that? And so a lot of people build technologies over the last 10 years or so that at the time worked, and in some ways still functionally work. But the way they solved this problem was by stripping out the people. So hence you've got tickets and queues. Ugh. You have do not reply email. All the functional things were kept, but the people were taken out. And that's not how we like to work and think, yeah. You know. Yeah. People are a social species. We want to talk to other people.
I think when you're also shaving margins down to nothing, and I think of the PC industry here where we as consumers have put such pressure on them to get the personal computer down from what used to be $2,500 to $500, the first thing to go is the most expensive thing, which is support. And having a human being talk to me about my computer problem is going to eat away at any profit almost instantly. So I'm sympathetic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a different way to think about it. We often say that customer service departments are cost centers. And
right.
That's how most people think about it. Like you said, they think about the overhead. They are optimized for ending conversations early.
They're not optimized for satisfaction. That's the problem.
Right. Our happiness. Absolutely. Yeah. And we've actually, in our own experience, honestly, of just using Intercom for Intercom, our business, seen the opposite be true, that actually our customer support team are one of the most strategic assets we've got. Because they're the only ones who are directly connected to our customers. They're hearing the highs and lows every day. And we, with Intercom, have built a system where they tag these conversations and those a summary of those conversations goes back straight back to the product team. So we actually build a lot of our own product off the back of what our customer support team say and do. And so as a result, we have scaled our customer support team. We are trying to make sure that we talk to all these customers directly as much as possible. But they've actually become this amazing strategic asset. And we don't think about the team as a cost center at all. We think about them as this amazingly connected strategic input into deciding what we build next.
That might be the biggest difference between a web services company and a company like Dell or Comcast. The Facebook's motto is build things and break things fast.
Move fast and break things. Yeah.
That makes sense. Last week we had David Heinemeier Hansen on, a creator of Ruby on Rails, and that was one of the things that made Ruby on Rails so interesting, is you could get within minutes a minimum viable product, something to show the customer, and begin the most profitable use of your time, which is a feedback loop with your customer. You like that? Mm-hmm. No, I don't like that. You like that? You know, I don't like that. So for web, and it made a lot of sense in web design. It probably makes a lot of sense in services. But for some reason, companies like computer companies, Dell was so famous for so long for the best customer service. I knew people down there in Round Rock who would answer the phone. They used to have, it was a giant bullpen, and they'd have signs. They had a DJ who played music on hold, so it was more interesting. They had signs up on how well you were doing, how customer satisfaction level. And when the prices for computers plummeted, all of that went away, and they outsourced their frontline customer support to overseas. And somebody wielding a notebook. It wasn't the same at all.
Yeah.
How do you convince them that what you're saying, that the virtuous circle is worth their effort? How do they see it as not a cost center?
I think it depends on the type of company. We have a range of different customers. Many of them are startups. I think for startups, this is somewhat intuitive and natural. They are trying to figure out what their product is, what their business is, whether it can be sustainable, all these things. And so they're heavily motivated to talk to people directly. They have a small customer base. And for them, it's we don't need to persuade them. Bigger companies like Dell, of course, it's way harder. They have all the absolutely correct concerns around how much this will cost and where will it end up and all that. And we just encourage them to start small.
It's a balancing act because they know, just as we know.
Yeah.
If a customer's unhappy, he's not going to buy another Dell. So you've got to somehow solve this problem at an effective price. I want to take a quick break. We're talking to Paul Adams. He's the VP of product at Intercom, but he has been a product designer for a long time at Facebook, at Google, and at Dyson. I was using my Dyson vacuum just this morning.
Yeah, sorry about that.
No, I love my Dyson. I love my Dyson.
I've left a long time ago, and I still have two Dysons.
Yeah. I had a buckwheat pillow, and we also have a kitten, a brand new cat, I've had this pillow for years. I love it. Who managed to somehow breach the fabric. There were buckwheat hulls everywhere, and I have one of those little portable Dysons.
Yeah.
So I know I'm not thanking you, but it is kind of amazing. Let's take a quick break. We're going to talk some more about product design and user interface design. We will talk, I promise, Paul, about Intercom, so you can get a nice plug-in for the product. But I think this is a topic dear to our hearts as geeks, because even though people who watch Twit are enthusiasts and generally are self-supporting enthusiasts, all of us, from time to time, have to make a call, have to connect to a company for support, for service, to return something. And we all know there's some companies that do it great and some companies that just make you tear your hair out. I'm thinking about you, Comcast. We'll come back and talk more about that in just a second. First, let me talk about our sponsor for the show today, something I use every single day, and I don't even have to do anything about using it because it's automatic. Oh, it's a good name. This is your car. Every car has been since 1996 has something called an onboard diagnostics port, or OBD. It's the OBD2 these days. And I can show you kind of what it looks like, because in the automatic packaging, they come with, you know, the thing is plugged into something that looks like an OBD port. So you'll look for this under your steering wheel. You have it. It's exposed. And most people don't even know it exists, but if you have seen it, you probably figure, well, that's for the service tech. I can't do anything with that. Oh, yes, you can. You can plug this baby in, and amazing things will happen. We talk about the quantified self a lot. The automatic is the quantified car. With the automatic, you pair it to your phone via Bluetooth. It's Android or iOS. And you get so much more information. There's the obvious stuff, like a check engine light's on. What does that mean? The automatic will tell your phone. You open up the app and it says, oh, here's what's wrong. And they'll even tell you, here's the nearest repair shop, or here's a list of repair shops that'll work on it. You want to know about your fuel mileage, for instance? That's something I'm always paying attention to. I was before I got a Tesla, because that's expensive. Gas is expensive. You can set custom low fuel warnings so you'll never be stranded. This is an amazing thing. How much that trip cost? I should open up my Evernote, because that's the other thing I do. I have it tied into If This Then That, and it will every time I take a trip, it will automatically log the information about that trip, where I went, how far I went, hard brakes, hard accelerations, and how much it cost to my Evernote. I have an Evernote notebook that is my mileage log. This is great, too, if you have to keep track of business expenses, mileage for business expenses. It'll do that automatically. They even interface with Concur and Expensify and FreshBooks, our sponsor FreshBooks. So you always know I used to have a notebook in the glove compartment. You don't have to do that. You always have exactly how much business mileage you've used. I love the automatic. The platform integrates not only with If This Then That, but the Amazon Echo. So I can ask my Echo, for instance, how much fuel is left in the car. That is pretty awesome. It works with your Nest. So if you really want to get crazy, you can have it. I love this. Turn up your thermostat when you're on your way home, or turn it down depending on what time of year it is. It works with your mechanic. It connects your car to your digital life, and that's what I love about this. Now, we got a deal for you. It's normally $99.95. There is no monthly fee or subscription. The app is free, so that's the total cost. You, by the way, they have a, you can see you have an Apple Watch interface as well, or a Pebble. You can locate your parked car on your watch or your Pebble. See that? I like that. I think that's cool. We got a special offer code, a TWIT offer code. If you go to automatic.com/TWIT, not $99.95, but 20% off. 20% off. Automatic is awesome. Finally, a use for that crazy OBD port. Underneath, it's kind of underneath your steering wheel on the driver's side, hidden down there. It is awesome. Automatic.com/TWIT. Wouldn't you love all this information? So useful. Automatic.com/TWIT. Our guest is Paul Adams. Would you say your real skill is UX design? Is that where you kind of come from? Is that where you cut your teeth?
Mostly. I started as an industrial designer, like you mentioned earlier, designing Dyson vacuum cleaners.
Wait a minute. I thought Mr. Dyson did that.
No, yeah, that's what you'd be led to believe.
Mr. Dyson?
Many young people in their 20s.
Which one did you work on?
Oh, my God. It was DC-14. It was the first Japanese cleaner, which had to be tiny. We had a little box. It was called the Box of Truth. It had to fit in there.
Because they have no room. They have small apartments.
Yeah, right, exactly. Yeah.
Wow.
Then I moved into web design, I guess. So yeah,
Dyson must be a dream come true, though, because that is, I mean, vacuum cleaners. You know, you tell your mom, oh, I'm going to go design vacuum cleaners. She'll say, well, it's nice somebody does that, I guess. But Dyson, it's like, wow. That's like space shuttle technology. It must have been fun. And they're in, as good designers, no, every design is a communication to the user. And Dyson has a very clear brand and communication they're making to the user, you know. And I imagine that that's part of the fun of it.
Yeah, it's an interesting company. Their brand design, I think, has always been very strong. The product is designed by young men mostly. I think it's designed for themselves. Which is a maybe great thing. But
I'm an old man, but when I was a young man, I sure liked them. I still do.
Yeah. I got one for most of my family, and my granny struggled with it a bit. I still struggle with it. Like now that I don't design them myself, so they're
now you can tell the truth. You don't.
Yeah,
have to.
That's right.
But there is something to be said for. You know, as you use the example, my car always seems to run better after I go to the car wash. There's something to be said for a design making you feel like your vacuum's working better, even if it's not. You can see the stuff going around. You can see the vortex. Yeah. It looks space age. Man, that thing must really suck in a good way.
They're fantastic. Like the technology is phenomenally good. They're fantastic. Like I said,
it does actually. Yeah,
I still buy them, despite them being more expensive than everything else.
Yeah, they're overpriced, and they probably aren't super reliable long term. I ended up. This is what happens when you get old. You'll know this in about 40 years, Paul. I ended up buying a German Miele vacuum. That looks like it should be named Bertha. It has no space age technology, but it never breaks. It lasts forever. It's like a tank, right?
Yeah.
So design can maybe not deceive, but mislead a little bit in the long run. All right, so from Dyson, you started doing the web. That's cool. Had you studied web UI or software UI?
Yeah, I originally studied industrial design. I graduated. I started work. This was the early 2000s. The internet was taking off. It was actually 2000. And as I did a master's in interactive media, which at the time just meant the internet, I think. And by the time I graduated,
or CD-ROMs, maybe.
I was using like all this macromedia software. Macromedia Director was the cool thing at the time. And I graduated just as the .bomb happened. So that's how I ended up at Dyson. And I guess as the internet picked up, I got back into that.
So that was your goal all along.
Yeah, it was kind of my passion. I was insanely curious about this new technology. It seemed that it had the the potential to revolutionize anything in sight. And being a young person following their dreams, I just, dove back into it.
One of my favorite books is from Donald Norman, The Design of Everyday Things. And that made me wish I were an industrial designer. Mm-hmm. He talks, obviously you've read it, but he talks about how the design tells you how to use something. And if something's hard to use, and I think this is just as true for software as it is for physical goods, if it's hard to use, it's a poor design. The design should lead you naturally into how to use it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's true for anything you design, from public spaces and cities all the way through hardware and products to software.
Yeah,
absolutely. And even the specialist software, you should have a mode whereby people progressively learn it. If it's really well designed, you kind of progressively get better and better and better.
Right.
And you don't need to take some training course.
There's a lot of jargon, I guess, in this, affordances, and I don't mm-hmm. even want to talk about, I don't even know them. I just hear them because when we do design for our apps or web design, I hear the designers saying these things, but I understand the gist of it, which is just kind of, it should be simple to discover it first, and then gradually, as you get more proficient, you should be able to use it more proficiently, and those tools should become available to you. But then I think of something like Snapchat, which is hugely successful, but seems to have a design. Maybe it's just because I'm old. A design from hell. It has no affordances. It doesn't tell you anything.
It breaks every. Yeah.
What do you think? It breaks every rule.
It breaks every rule. Yeah.
But it works.
So we actually have this debate a lot here at Intercom where we talk about the level of innovation that we kind of play at. And the innovation level we do not play at is UI design. So
don't innovate in the UI.
Yeah. Like people expect that to be a button. Make it a button. You know.
We had a massive debate about the hamburger menu for a long time. People said, don't use those. No one knows what that means.
Right. Yeah. And like all these things, like you said, you know, with the affordances, the people come into things with expectations of how they work, and those expectations should be met, which doesn't mean that you can't design new things. But then Snapchat breaks every rule. And there's kind of like a theory here amongst the product and design team that Snapchat is actually a game. Like if you were to categorize a lot of the interactions in it and think about what's happening and what people are doing, a lot of it's very game oriented.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
And people are
it appeals to younger people because they want to explore. They wanted to learn. They're in that mode anyway.
Yeah, and find new things and be the first to tell other people about the new thing.
Man, you're confirming what I've thought all along. I think that's an intentional design feature that you don't give them a manual.
Makes me feel better.
Yeah, you see games like this too, where you figure it out. But they're so smart because it gets you the word of mouth, because if you figure it out, you know, and now you tell your peers, and you feel good, and you're spreading the gospel of Snapchat. Okay, good. I'm glad you said that independently, because I've thought that for a while, that actually that's kind of brilliant.
Yeah, it's either me making myself feel better about not being able to use it as I get older, or it's true.
Well, I asked my son. I have a 21-year-old. Your daughters are too young. They're still not using Snapchat. They're only 4.
Yeah.
But my son's 21, and that's all he uses. I mean, really, all he uses.
Yeah.
A little Instagram, but mostly Snapchat. And I say, Henry, how do you? He says, it's obvious. No, but how do you? Come on, what do you do now? Oh, it's obvious.
Right.
And it's not obvious. But it's gamified. No. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head.
Yeah, and I'd say the team there have a pretty strong design philosophy. You know, this is not because
it's
they didn't
accidental.
Read the same books. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. They're going for something. Pokemon Go kind of did the same thing, I think. They didn't really come with much of a manual. You had to figure it out. But then people share, and they go, I figured out what those paw prints mean. And there's this kind of natural word of mouth. We're talking, we should talk about Intercom a little bit. We're talking to Paul Adams. He's a VP of product at Intercom. We're going to get there. You went Did you go to Facebook right away? Where did you go first after Dyson?
After Dyson, I worked in a UX consultancy in London called Flow Interactive, which don't exist anymore. But at the time, it was a hip-hop happening place to be.
I bet.
And from there, I went to Google.
Google? And what did you do at Google?
Yeah. I joined the user experience team. Spent most of my time there as a researcher.
You weren't the guy who had to show Marissa Meyer 15 different shades of blue and say, which one should we A/B test?
Yeah, no, I didn't. I thankfully wasn't involved in that.
But a good lesson at Google, because I'm told they're very data-driven, right? Even in UI.
Yeah, definitely at the time. Like, I've left Google, I'm trying to count the years, 6 years, 7 years ago. And when I was there, UX was still emerging as a discipline. And it was, you know, up against engineering and product management, which PM, product management, was also like emerging somewhat, whereas engineering was obviously established for a long time. And it was still finding its feet. And as a result, I think a lot of the conversations were data-driven. Quantitative data, and I believe from talking to people who still work there that I knew at the time, it's changed and a lot. Not all over the company, but the appreciation for design and the value design brings to the table, I think, has increased a lot. You can kind of see it in the products as well, things like material design.
Material design, gorgeous, and you can't focus group that really. I mean, I guess you could do usability testing on it, but this is a battle I often have with designers. Because designers, correct me if I'm wrong, really think they know best, right?
I don't know about that. I think it depends on the designer you're talking to.
I get the sense sometimes, you just don't have any taste. If you knew what you were talking about, you'd see that that is poorly kerned and the color is really too bright. That kind of thing. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think there's a whole level from incredibly subjective. Like,
it is subjective. That's kind of been my take on it.
Some of it is. Yeah. I think some of it's very subjective. Some of it is somewhere in the middle. There's objective too. Like I was saying earlier, you know, material design is very physics oriented.
It's intuitive because of that, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. And that's somewhat objective, I think. That's just objectively better. And you, like I said earlier, shouldn't be reinventing the drop-down menu in your app, you know. Right. Just use the drop-down menu the same way everyone else does. And then in the middle is the hard bit, which is where designers from experience, especially from watching and interacting with a lot of their customers, their users use the product, have built up this kind of innate sense of what's better.
Right.
And people who have not watched others use the software don't have that innate sense, but the whole thing appears to be quite subjective, whereas actually there is some science behind it.
We know, yeah. On the other hand, I agree with you if you hate Comic Sans, but you can't say objectively. Maybe you could. I don't know. Can you say objectively that's a terrible font? You should never use it.
I don't hate Comic Sans as much. I'm going to live to regret saying this. I don't hate Comic Sans as much as everybody else. I hate Tappers even more. You know, if you're making a poster for your kid's birthday,
Comic Sans, baby,
you can like knock it out in Comic Sans in 5 minutes.
It's fun.
Hour two, yeah. But I don't think the 5-year-old kids are going to complain about it.
So not everything is Helvetica for you.
I've changed a bit. There was a period of time in my life where everything was
Bauhaus,
like Switzerland.
Yeah,
it was white with black Helvetica and maybe like a red stripe.
Right.
White, black, and red.
Swiss railway design.
Yeah, they were my dogmatic years.
Yeah, but you know that is elegant and beautiful, and I could see how you know people would say this is gorgeous. But I guess as one has more experience, you start to see that there's value to even Comic Sans.
Yeah. I mean, if the whole world looked like Helvetica, it would be an incredibly boring place to be.
True. Although I remember, where was I? Was it Turkey? The big signs for stores were in Comic Sans. And I thought, that is probably not the best choice.
Might be a step too far.
Yeah. One step too far. We're talking with Paul Adams. He's VP of Product at Intercom. Also the author of a book, which I think is really interesting, called Grouped. How the web has gone away from being, you know, a bunch of linked documents and pages to well, it's made of people. And I guess that's kind of informed what you're doing at Intercom. as well. We'll talk more about that in just a second. I love talking to designers, especially designers who aren't dogmatic, because then we can have a conversation. We went back and forth on the hamburger menu. We have one.
Yeah, I think the jury is still out.
It's still out.
We had a passionate on both sides.
Exactly. We had a wonderful design team in Austin. Four Kitchens was their name, and you might know them. And half of them said you can't use it because nobody knows what it means. It's just three lines to most people. And then to us, well, on mobile, you don't have any space. You have to have some, you know, what are you going to do, an ellipsis? So we compromised. When we have the screens real estate on our website, it says, I think it says more, dot, dot, dot. Mm-hmm. And then when you squeeze it down, because it's mobile responsive, at some point it turns into a hamburger. And we just cross our fingers that people. Nowadays, I think even Google's using a hamburger. Everywhere there's hamburgers. Chrome uses a hamburger. Our show today brought to you by, I want to talk about the book too, and yes, I keep promising you, we'll talk about Intercom, I promise.
It's okay.
Yeah. Is it an Irish company?
It's actually headquartered in San Francisco.
Okay.
Founded by four Irish guys.
Nice.
Four guys from Dublin, yeah. Owen, Daz, Kieran, and David. And Owen is based, he's our CEO and co-founder, he's based in San Francisco. Kieran and David are here in Dublin, and Daz is between the two in an airplane half the time.
Poor guy. Our show today brought to you by the folks who know glass, Corning. You know their name, you know Gorilla Glass. I bet you when you were a little younger, you might have had some Corningware in the house. They do make fiber optic cables. And I know when you say fiber optic, people think state of the art, high speed, you're using light. And then anybody who's had any experience with fiber optic might also say, and it's delicate, you can't bend it, you can't step on it, don't use, oh man. I remember we put fiber optic cables in here 5 years ago, and they said, whatever you do, Leo, don't bend that, don't step on it. We put it up in the ceiling so nobody could. Not anymore. Corning has used their amazing knowledge of how glass works to create fiber optic cables for you and for your home that are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. I want you to go to corning.com/twit to learn about their new Thunderbolt and USB 3.0 fiber optic cables. They are amazing. And there's a real advantage to using these cables from Corning. You can take the hot, noisy stuff, the hard drives and so forth, and put them somewhere else. So, for instance, Universal Audio, which I don't know if you know them, they design amazing Thunderbolt audio interfaces, and they want to test them. The last thing you want to do with your test equipment is have those noisy hard drives in there, right? So they use Corning optical cables to achieve acoustic isolation. They just, because, well, I'll tell you why. I have some cables here somewhere. You know what I do? The problem is I keep taking them home because I love them. So the idea is the USB 3.0 will go for 50 meters, 165 feet. So that's longer than any USB cable without any degradation. The thing they've done that's smart is they've actually built a transceiver into each end of it that takes the signal from the Thunderbolt or the USB connector, turns it into light, sends it down the wire, beep, 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 beep. And then on the other end, the light is turned back into an RF signal or whatever it is. I don't know what it is for the copper. So that's how they handle this. You can go 200 feet for Thunderbolt. And, of course, all the speed of Thunderbolt 3 and USB 3.0. You will love these cables. They're available at all major electronics and professional AV retailers. And, of course, Apple stores, Amazon, B&H, Corning optical cables. They are longer, thinner, lighter, and stronger. And if you go to corning.com/twit right now, you can save up to $130 on these Thunderbolt cables. That's valid only to the end of the month, August 31st, or while supplies last, whichever comes first. So better get there now. corning.com/twit, save up to $130 on their unbeatable Thunderbolt cables. I'm doing all my drives, all my external drives now. Thunderbolt, it's amazing. And some of them, I have one or two computers that HP can do Thunderbolt 3. And man, that is That is greased lightning. And it feels even faster when I'm using Thunderbolt cables from Corning. They're glass, man. It's optics. Corning.com/twit. Save today. Our guest, and I'm really glad to have him, Paul Adams. He is at a company called Intercom. We better find out what Intercom does, Paul. We've put it off long enough. You're VP of product there. How did it come about? Let's start there.
Yeah, it came about because very simply, the four founders that I mentioned earlier had a different app called Exceptional, which was an app for tracking exceptions in the cloud. It was a SaaS product, and they basically couldn't see or talk to their customers. And they would go over to a nearby coffee shop in here in Dublin and lament the fact that the coffee owner, Colin Harmon is his name, who ran a coffee shop called 3FE, he could talk to his customers. He could see them. He could talk to them. He could get feedback. If they had a problem, they talked to him. He could learn. There's these short feedback loops, basically. And they lamented that they could not do that for their app. And so they built a little widget inside their app to collect information about who the users were. And it was also a way to message them. And so at the time, today, if you looked at the V1 of this, you would actually say it looks a lot like a Messenger app. At the time, of course, Messenger apps didn't really exist. And they basically built it as a way to see their users, segment them down into, people who had different criteria. And yes, our messenger down there in the bottom right now.
That's Tim. That's Tim saying, "Do you want to talk?"
Yeah. So Tim's there. You're looking at the messenger page, and Tim is saying, "Hey, if you got questions, talk to us, and you can talk to Tim. He'll talk back. I hope if he's around."
Now, so this is
he was active in the last 15 minutes.
Yeah.
So he's around.
So, and by the way, your reply shows up here, and then you can get an email or a Facebook message if Tim has wandered away.
Yeah.
And then so
yeah, there is.
So it's kind of like Slack, but instead of being inter-team communication, this is customer-to-vendor communication.
Yes, this is basically connecting the people inside a business. Mm-hmm. In this case, Tim is inside Intercom, with customers, potential customers. So you kind of browsing our website here, our potential customer, talking to Tim, you can get your questions answered. And it works not just for these types of interactions. It also works for customer support. So if you're logged into an app and you have a question, it's exactly the same thing. Or for outbound messaging, you can trigger messages off behavior. And so send different messages to help people get started, get onboarded, send them little tips. And the whole idea, honestly, is that this is like a modern technology experience. Most of the products that exist elsewhere are things like live chat, which for the most part isn't live. And if you look at consumer technology...
You get a robot, I think. When I talk to Comcast in their chat room, I don't think there's a human on the other end.
Potentially not. or you get a form to fill in. They say, we're not online. Fill in this form.
Oh, Tim's just popped up.
Tim's around. Hey, Tim.
Hey. Oh, and I like it. You can put, we can do animated... GIFs and stuff, right?
It's a modern messaging experience. That's the idea.
Yeah.
Consumer technology has moved on. We use WhatsApp and Snapchat and all manner.
We expect more, don't we?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
We're simply bringing that to the world of business.
Yeah. Poor Tim's trying to work and I'm bugging him.
This is work.
But what I like about it is it's synchronous and asynchronous. And I think we look for that kind of – that's one of the reasons solutions like HipChat and Slack have become so popular in Teams is email is very asynchronous. You send it and then you wait and then you get something back. And so this is more can be more immediate than email, but at the same time can have that kind of store and forward experience that email gives you and have a record of the thing. So it combines two things quite well. Oh, look, he sent me a bear waving. This is nice too, because frankly, when you're talking to customer service, you're not usually in a good mood. So it's nice that he can send kind of fun stuff.
Yeah. You can learn about Tim too. Go up there and click on Tim up there in the top.
Yeah. Oh, he's in San Francisco.
Yeah.
He's a
yeah.
He's a tech enthusiast, former Politico, and recovering documentary enthusiast, savant. Neat.
Yeah. Neat. So the whole idea is we're just trying to break down these barriers. You know, if you met Tim in real life, you would say, "Hey, Tim," and he'd say, "Hey, Leo," and then something along the lines of, "Where are you from? Where did you grow up? Where did you go to school?"
Right.
And these are the types of small little kickstarters that help build relationships and just get people to trust each other a bit more, connect a bit
more
deeply.
It's personal.
Yeah, exactly.
I like the idea. It's not the only thing that Intercom does, right? But this was the first product, the Messenger.
Yes, we've got different products. One is customer support teams. One's for sales teams. One's for marketing teams. They all use the Messenger in different ways. So it's kind of this underlying technology, but there's a lot more going on as well.
Yeah, I have to say, I love Messenger. On the other hand, I'm a little worried because when Facebook introduced bots, I realized that the only reason I really like messaging apps is because they're much more limited. But as soon as I get as many messages as I get emails, it's going to be worse than email because I don't have all the tools that email gives me for filtering and processing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's going to be an interesting space to watch the next file.
I had a few bots, and I couldn't wait to turn them off. They were just annoying.
Yeah, the problem with bots is that bots were this overhyped, temporary frenzy, and people realized fast that humans are better than bots at many things, and bots weren't this like silver bullet.
No.
But bots are good for simple automate things that can be automated, but talking to people is typically better for these types of communication.
I use something, I'm trying to remember the name of it. I think it's called Finn, that goes through my email and finds, I love this idea, recurring transactions, because I sign up for everything. And and it goes through it and says, "Hey, you know, you've been paying this for months. You really want," and it'll cancel it for you.
All right.
That's a good use.
That's useful.
Yeah, and it doesn't bug me. You can set it up that it'll send you little messages when you have, you know, a transaction that's beyond your limit or whatever. But so there are useful, actually, Finn is the one that Sam Lesson did, right? That's the one.
Right. Yeah,
I have Sam Lesson's Finn. What's the one that does my there's another one that does my finances. It's not Finn. Finn is expensive. Finn is $150. The one that does my finances is free, so I like that.
I'm not sure what that one is.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I'll find the name because it'll drive me crazy. By the way, Tim says this sounds like a podcast that he'd be interested in listening to. And I will write, "You will love it, especially the part about Tim." And then I'll send him the link.
It's like it's a little bit like Inception. It's like a interception.
It is a very weird thing going on. Yes.
Right. Tim watching Tim.
Tim's watching Tim talking to Tim. Let's talk. Let's take a break and talk about the book. I want to because it's still available. It's available on Amazon and also on Audible. We're big fans of Audible.com, and there's an audio edition of it. It's called "Grouped: How Small Groups of Friends Are the Key to Influence on the Social Web," and I'd love to hear more about that. And maybe we can get Comcast. Somebody's saying if Comcast just had little animated GIFs in there, everything would be much, much better. Maybe we can.
The world would be a better place, you know, little piece by little piece.
They have terrible chat tool. It's horrible. Animated GIF makes everything just a little bit better. It's like Parmesan cheese or ground pepper. Just everything tastes a little bit better. Our show today brought to you by Wealthfront. Wealthfront, you'll love. It's a low-cost automated investment service. Not human, but better than human. So if you are saving for the long term, like, for instance, let's say you have twin four-year-olds who are going to be going to college in just 14 years, you better start saving for that college fund, right? But what do you do with that money that you're putting away? Do you put it in the mattress? Do you put it in a savings account? No. You want to invest it, and invest it in the market, but invest it wisely. Now, you may think, as I did, you have the time, and I read all the books. In fact, I read some of the books that the people at Wealthfront wrote And I thought, well, I'm gonna do this. I opened an account at a discount broker, and I started investing. This is about 10 years ago, and then I just kind of got busy, and I forgot. And I checked back a few years later, not doing as well as I'd hoped, because it turns out you got to pay attention to your investments. So maybe you're going to hire an investment advisor. That guy who put the shingle out down the street, right, in the strip mall. Problem with that is he'll charge you 1, 2, sometimes even 3% of what they manage every single year, not to mention hidden fees and transaction costs. That's going to add up. That means you have to make that much more to get ahead. So I got the best of both worlds. These are the books I read. A Random Walk Down Wall Street, Merton Malkiel, The Elements of Investing, Charles D. Ellis, Winning the Loser's Game. What a classic. 500,000 copies in print. Obviously, others trying to understand how to invest. So that's who Wealthfront hired to create the software that keeps track of your investments and reinvests and redistributes and does tax loss harvesting and all sorts of fancy things on your behalf. And they do it all the time, not every month, every quarter, every week, every day, every minute of every day. They make sure that you're maximizing your investments. And they do it for not 1 or 2 or 3% a year, but for 0.25% a year. That is a deal. Because you know why? Computers work cheap. Go to wealthfront.com/triangulation and read all about it. They have some free things you can do right up front. And I encourage you to do them. For instance, you can answer a few questions. They've really stripped this down. They've used Nobel Prize winning academic research to make it simple. So you just answer a handful of questions, and they'll generate a portfolio for you, which is yours to keep. That's free. So you can start investing right away, not even use them if you want. They also have a dashboard that lets you track all your accounts in one place, both Wealthfront and non-Wealthfront. They will even analyze your current portfolio to see how much of it's at risk, how diversified it is, what you're losing to fees, and how you can minimize taxes. All of that's free. Once you're comfortable with it, though, I want you to check it out as an investment tool for yourself, for your future. Good for long-term investing of all kinds. They just introduced a 529 college savings plan, which is kind of like a Roth IRA for college savings. You could get started as little as $500, and they have a really nice offer for people who watch this show. If you go to wealthfront.com/triangulation, they will manage your first $15,000 free of charge forever. So at the very least, do that for your nest egg, right? The first 15 grand free of charge, not for the first year, but forever. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. This is the future of investing. Give it a try today. Wealthfront.com/triangulation. We thank them so much for their support of the Triangulation Show on the Twit Network. My guest, we're talking about a company called Intercom, is Paul Adams. He's the VP of product at intercom.com. You couldn't get inter.com, probably.
No.
That'd be good.
No, it, yeah.
Somebody's got that, I'm sure.
Someone has. Somewhere early.
Was this before you joined Intercom when you wrote the book Grouped?
It was, yeah. I wrote it when I was at Facebook.
Ah. What did you were doing design at Facebook as well?
Yeah, I had two roles there. For about half my time there as a product manager. And then for the other half, I was a designer.
What product were you managing?
I was managing our ads, our customer-facing ad units. I was a product manager for ad units, which at the time only had one.
That's right. I remember there was one in the corner.
Times have
changed. Right there. Yeah. Yeah. You know, Facebook, I have to say, I mean, if anybody compares what Facebook does to almost any other site on the web, it's very unobtrusive and not bothersome at all. And they've really done mobile very well. I look at what they're doing. What do you think? You know, Instagram is an interesting, I would guess, a test bed for Facebook. They own it, of course, and it's a smaller group of people, only, 600 million instead of 1.5 billion. They just added Snapchat-like capabilities to it, the stories functionality.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah. Of which part? The Snapchat part?
Any part that you feel comfortable talking about.
I don't think... I actually have no idea if Instagram is a testbed for Facebook functionality. I do know. I'm not surprised to see the advertising products be incredibly user-centered.
Instagram's a perfect example. When they first started doing it, I thought, oh, I'm going to hate this. But they must work with the advertisers, because even the ads are aesthetically, you know, they're not jarring. Right. You know, I'm not. If I had a big belly fat ad in the middle of my nice Instagram pictures, I'd be pissed. But actually, they work. I bought a couple of things now because every 10th Instagram post, there's a tasteful little video or something, and often it's a product I end up buying. So that's my. I've never bought anything from a banner ad ever.
Yeah, they've two good things going on there. One is the design team for all the ad products are optimizing a lot of that experience for the end user as opposed to the advertiser, which historically is new. You know, most publishers of content historically would maximize their experience for the advertiser and kill themselves in the process, honestly. So Facebook have been very good at that. They have a very good design and product team, I know, in their ads part of the business. And then there's another team that I worked in as well. It's run by a fantastic guy called Mark Darcy. And that team works directly with advertisers around content. Had a great content that people actually want to see, content that works well in Facebook and Instagram and so on. So I think those efforts have shown a lot of fruit. You know, they've borne a lot of fruit, as you said yourself.
You wrote this book grouped in 2011. It's now 5 years, believe it or not, 5 years ago. What do you think of your thesis, of your predictions? Have they come true? Are they things you would change?
I think they have come true. I'm not entirely sure that was anything to do with me. it was a pretty obvious thing, honestly. I worked in a lot of the social products at Google, and then obviously I worked at Facebook after that. And it was just very obvious to me and other people at the time that the internet was going to orient itself around people. This early architecture around pages was a temporary construct. You know, all media and communication technologies follow this cycle where they look back at the past and look at the way things work in the present and apply that logic to the new technology. So hence we have web pages. Pages are from books and magazines. A lot of the early web pages looked like magazines and books. But it was obvious that it was going to change. And if you just look at a very basic, deep thing about human beings, is that we are social. Right. We live to connect to other people.
Right.
And that the web would architect itself that way. Like every other media and communication technology has effectively architected itself that way. And the internet would be no different. And I think that phase of the internet is past. You know, we're beyond the point where anyone argues that
it's
social web.
Now. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Like there was a time when I had to debate with people and try and persuade them that the social web was a thing that would stick around.
Yeah. Well, you knew and you were right. You worked at Google Plus early on, right?
I did. Yeah. I was there for its inception.
Loved Google Plus. What went wrong?
It's easy for me in hindsight to pick holes in it. I think the biggest thing that went wrong was a lack of focus. I think Google Plus did a lot of things and did a lot of the same things that Facebook did. And there were some things that were better than Facebook. But honestly, the kind of advantage or the increase in value that it had over Facebook was so small that people weren't going to move, you know. There's like a lot of social dynamics and inertia that at play here. And the example I used to use back in the day was, you know, if you have a kind of a dingy nightclub, by the way, this was an apt analogy back then because Facebook was a bit buggy and a bit rough around the edges. If you have a dingy nightclub and it's like happening in there and people are having the time of their lives and it's full and someone opens a new nightclub next door, which is nicer and a bit fancier and shinier and the edges are better, but it's basically the same. You're just not moving everyone in next door. Right. You know, that's not how social work.
MySpace was like the worst dingy nightclub. Facebook capitalized on how horrible MySpace was, right?
Yeah, I think they're fundamentally different, though. You know, Facebook was grounded in like real life friendships. That's where that's what it That's where it started from. Whereas, I don't know what MySpace was. Originally bands, I guess, but people who didn't know each other often. It was such a ambiguous time. I think Facebook was the first company to truly understand the social dynamics at play and the things that real normal people actually wanted and needed.
Mark Zuckerberg's really proven to be a genius, I think, and continues to make these subtle moves, pulling the levers, and it's fascinating to watch.
Yeah.
I think I and my ilk, which were mostly tech journalists and enthusiasts, loved Google Plus because we could have, I don't know, more cerebral conversations. It was more about a conversation than a news feed. And in my gut, I far preferred it. But I think we were in the minority. I think it might have been as simple as that. Because I always wanted a threaded Twitter too, and I left Twitter for a number of threaded solutions like Jaiku, and nobody followed me because nobody wanted threads. They want this kind of disorganized mess that is Twitter.
Yeah.
I far prefer it. You write in your book Grouped that really the key to all of this is understanding how humans are behaviorally and have been for forever, right? It seems new, but it's old wine in new bottles.
Yeah, that's the thing. The way I used to describe this to people was that technology changes very fast, but people and society don't. They change really slowly. And actually, in many cases, probably most cases, the motivations that people have actually stay the same. And it's the behaviors that change. And we actually do a lot of this at Intercom too in our design process. We actually try and look at what are the stable motivations that people have, because they're usually very, very similar and very stable over time. And then design for those, as opposed to designing for the latest kind of hot technology thing. And I think Google Plus suffered a bit from that. You know, the team weren't studying the actual the deep-lying sociological, psychological motivations and pandering a bit too much to the technology, I think.
Yeah. That's always a risk with engineers and techies in general. We're enthusiasts for the new thing. And so we get sucked in by the shiny new thing. And we don't think about it.
It's very easy.
Yeah. We don't think about our monkey minds.
Yeah. Actually, or the fact that we all live in a bubble. This is like we live in this crazy tech bubble. All of Silicon Valley is this bubble. Yeah. Most of the rest of the world does not operate this way.
Yeah. I highly recommend the book. I know people probably look at it and go, oh, a book about marketing and the internet from 5 years ago, that's got to be out of date. But no, it really is about kind of timeless things that have proven to be true, that are still true.
And I did write it to try and stand the test of time as much as possible. Yeah. That's not a pitch. That's actually what I tried to do. Yeah. So it's nice to hear that it's still relevant.
Yeah. And anybody who has to, market and plan a way to, the internet's made of people, and you want to interact with people and sell your product to people, it's really valuable to learn about it. I also want to encourage people to visit Intercom. It's actually not intercom.com. I said it wrong. It's intercom.io.
So, that's right.
Intercom.io. And you have a free trial there, I think, so people can try it.
We do. You can go. You can open our messenger. You can chat to Tim and similarly great people.
I really think you can try
it for free.
I really want Comcast and Dell and all these companies who are trying to do this to take a look at something like this and say, let's make it a little more fun, a little more personal, a little more human. Because after all, ultimately, a good customer experience is going to come down to did they enjoy this interaction they had with our company?
I think
it was Gary Vaynerchuk who told me that every interaction you have with a company is either going to be a plus or a minus. Mm-hmm. And you want to add them up. You don't want to subtract them. And so every chance you have to talk to a customer is a chance to help yourself. And so few companies seem to do that.
Yeah. It's very easy to get started, too. You know, like Gary said, there's many, many small interactions We used to talk about it as many lightweight interactions. That's what relationships are built on. They're not built on, you know, great one-off huge things. It's just all the many small things. It's very easy to just get started, talk to a very small number of your customers, see if it works. You learn quickly. There's lots of value there. You iterate and try in new places with new other types of customers you have.
Paul Adams, he's the VP of product at Intercom, intercom.io. Let's make sure you get the right address, intercom.io, if you want to find out more. The book, Grouped, How Small Groups of Friends Are the Key to Influence on the Social Web, is in paperback on Amazon. But you can also, I know a lot of you are Audible listeners, you can also get it on Audible. It's a nice, quick read. You didn't narrate it, but you're in the...
I didn't.
Yeah. The forward.
I did not. There's a very nice voice narrating it.
Eric Michael Summerer narrates. Yeah. You want to hear certainly a little bit of it? Have you heard it? Have you ever heard it?
I have heard parts of it, yeah.
Thank you so much for your time, Paul. I appreciate it. Paul Adams.
Thanks for having me.
Great to talk to you. We do triangulation every Monday, about 11 a.m. Pacific. That would be 2 p.m. Eastern, 1800 UTC. If you want to join in, I love having you. You can join us in the chat room, be part of the conversation. You can also join us after the fact. We make on-demand audio and video of everything available. If you're listening right now on an airplane, we're glad to have you. And you'll find lots more of this and other conversations about technology and society at twit.tv. In the case of this show, all of our 260 episodes are at twit.tv/TRI, but you can also find it in your favorite podcast application. There's even a Twit application, many Twit applications in some cases, thanks to our devoted and talented listeners. I think we have 5 apps now on Apple TV, on Roku there's an app, on Windows Phone, yes, there's a Windows, very good Windows Phone app, Android and iOS too. Or use iTunes or whatever, but subscribe. You don't want to miss an episode. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.